Ryan.
Hey, how's it going?
What's going on, man?
Oh, just living
the
dream.
It's always good to see you, man. Last time I saw you was at evening.
Yes.
We'll touch upon a little bit, but no, it's always good. It's always good to hear from you. I love chatting with you. I love what you're doing. I love that you care so much about the industry and you're passionate about trying to change it. I've been told similar things, which is good, which is great.
Good.
And so we got you back in the studio and we're going to talk about some interesting things because yes. I know that recently I shared some comments about how the work is out there.
Yep.
And I still believe the work is out there.
Yep.
You just have to figure out how to navigate.
Absolutely.
Through the construction waters out there, and you'll find some work out there. So construction survives.
Yes.
And a lot of people have gone through far worse situations that we're going through right now. Mm-hmm. So that's what this show is going to be all about.
Yeah, 100%.
I want to talk about that, right? So it's good to have you. Let me share the information before everyone's back. They're listening again. I'm trying to remember what show number you were at.
Show number?
Yeah, what was it? Do you remember? I don't know.
I can't remember off the top of my
head. Should always do this homework afterwards. I don't know. 500 something. I can't remember. Ryan Magowski is here, the exterior specialist, www.exteriorspecialist.ca. Find him on IG under the exterior specialist. And also you can email him at info@exteriorspecialist.ca. 514. You can have the first conversation that we can have. But now we're going to have the second follow-up. And I'm sure there's going to be many more.
I would hope so, yeah. The purpose of me being on the podcast is genuinely I want to share information that maybe other people don't have access to or don't have the time to look up. And so to your point, I remember you speaking on a few podcasts that, you know, some guys are messaging you saying they're slow and that, you know, they think the work's drying up. I think a lot of people maybe have a false interpretation of it, just kind of hearsay or anecdotal evidence. So yeah, like we did with the labor shortage, let's look at the whole picture and make our conclusions from that versus just what the talk is and not get scared because you heard one story here and a different story there.
There's a lot of, I guess you can blame digital platforms, but there is a lot of construction noise going on. And I know politicians like using these hot button topics, labor shortage, work and housing prices and all this other stuff. But they're not really solving anything. And I get a little irritated when my time, especially that I'm halfway through my life, is consumed by things that are not working.
Right.
So I really want to be valuable by my time. And I'm very appreciative of anybody who's listening to this show where I consider these kinds of shows that you bring to the table here more educational, where you literally probably have to listen to it a second or a third time to get the gist of it.
Yeah.
Right. To really understand what we're going to dive into this conversation, because I think you have to think about this one. It's great that everyone could listen to the show and get some nice feedback and get a better understanding of people and their personalities and what they've contributed to the construction industry as a trade, as an individual.
Right.
But the construction life has always been also a part of making the industry a lot better.
Yes.
To do that, you literally got to dive in deep and try to figure out where are the problems going on here. When we got certain people that are starting organizations or coming from the government, never worked where, always suits, and just have a committee that tells them this is what's wrong.
Right.
But I'm not going to listen to a committee that's never been on a job site.
Yes.
I need to listen to people that have, lack of a better term, rough hands, have been on a job site, and we know who they are. But the problem is that they don't want to be politicians. They don't want to be knocking on those doors. Mm-hmm. So that's why I've said it several times on this show. We're on our own. We have to solve our own problems. And sure, housing, labor, work, these are all our problems.
Yep.
Don't look towards other people to solve this. If you want to look towards other tradespeople that are going through similar situations, whether it's in this province or other provinces or territories in this country or even down south or globally, then start looking towards those avenues and start getting some answers from them, right? So these shows that are, these are all about answers. These are all trying to figure out, okay, what is the root cause?
Yes.
And how do we solve some of this, right?
Absolutely. So like what you said, maybe we don't even have the answer yet, but at least we need to all operate with the same understanding of the root cause or the root problem. So yeah, given the economic environment, you know, we're not economists. We can't predict that stuff, right? But what we can do is we can look at just the publicly available information. And then we can see what the trends are. So that way, moving forward in your business, you know where to position yourself to best grow your business or to hedge against a slowdown in a certain section or a certain area. So that's why I put together this information so that way I can share it with everyone in the industry Basically looking at Statistics Canada information, because yes, a politician may say X, Y, and Z, but the numbers don't lie. And they're, if they're collected the same way year after year after year, it gives us reliable information to go on versus like what you heard on the news or what you saw on Instagram or what your buddy told you. So,
and, or what you want to hear.
That's true.
Right?
That's
like, true. I think a lot of people don't want to really face it. And at that point, you might as well just rip the Band-Aid off and understand that you need to face this. So if anything, just looking into this data and trying to get a better understanding of what's really going on,
yep.
I can confidently say that it's going to help you, not hinder you.
Yes.
As a business owner, as a tradesperson, as someone that's in the industry, mm-hmm. it will definitely help you.
100%. And so, yeah, at our last meeting there, the Constructors Guild, which a lot of good insights from that. But the one thing was there was a point in the night where the host had asked, like, what's your ask of everyone here, right? And so one of the things, or my ask, and one of the things I like to think about a lot is there's what should be and what is, right? So in other words, yes, it's not desirable the way it is, and it should be like this, but we need to accept reality and just acknowledge the situation as it is and then move forward from that. Wishful thinking is not going to get you very far, no. But if you can operate or make decisions based on objective information, I think you'll be a lot better over time than by complaining or being upset about what should be and that it's not that way.
So, well, the older trades that have survived these cycles,
yep,
that's what they did.
Yep.
Like they didn't have the data or they didn't have the resources to find out this information, but they questioned things differently.
Yes.
So they never really complained about this sucks. Mm-hmm. Like work's not coming in. That wasn't not an option. And I think that, you know, you see it in immigrants coming to this country. You see it in certain individuals that are thriving. So mm-hmm. there is, you can't question the industry as a whole when there's a certain segment that's still working really well and they're running their business really well.
Absolutely.
So they're in the same city, they're in their backyard, mm-hmm. they're doing similar work that you're doing, but yet they're thriving and you're not. You're having a hard time trying to get work. So what's really the factor here?
Yes.
That's what we want to dive into this show about, right?
Absolutely. Yep. And then, so we can get into it.
Yeah,
and
you're calling this market trend charts, right?
Yeah, I mean, I could probably put a better name, but I was working on this over the weekend. And again, I'm not, this isn't like a full-time thing. I probably committed.
Not yet.
Maybe one day, we'll see. Yeah. But I probably committed about 8-9 hours. So if there's any incorrect information, or if there's any information that maybe someone else can provide better or more accurate information, I'm always open to constructive feedback. And again, the purpose is just to leverage your platform, which I think is fantastic, to share this with someone who doesn't have the same resources that we've worked hard for years to acquire.
Yeah.
Right. So, in discussing the labor shortage, it will not help us to add to the labor pool if there's these rumors going on about these slowdowns and shortages. Because, you know, we keep hearing we need 10 million houses by this date, which, you know, or whatever the number is, which we do. But the rumors of a work slowdown is not going to entice people to still pursue the industry as a career choice.
Yeah.
So let's sort of just provide the objective information and you make your own conclusion from there.
That's basically it. Simple as that. So you got data here. So you're going as far back as just over 12 years.
So this would have been the information from Statistics Canada.
So this would have been right after the last semi recession, which would have been 2009.
That I'm not entirely sure of.
Well, that was a housing crash.
Okay. I was
in the US
school.
And then we were like Harper. We didn't have the same hit of a crash because Harper, the conservatives.
The 2008.
2009, okay. Slight recession that we had, right? There was a dip then. So it's interesting that this information is coming right after a few years after that.
Yes.
To today, right?
Yeah, and that was as far back as I could go on the Statistics Canada website. And I'm going to provide the link and the website. So anyone who is interested
can put it in the show notes.
Yeah, they can go play around with it. They can go check out whatever piece of information. But I just took the information that would give us the best picture and then converted it into some charts. So that way there's not a lot of words and you can just see it visually. I've heard a lot of concern over the market slowing down or potential slowdowns. Wanted to provide some information. For anyone looking for employment, half the battle is knowing where to look.
Yep.
And the information presented will position yourself or your business for success moving forward.
All right. So that's the link there, right?
Yeah, that's the link. And so if you're going to go, take a look for yourself on the website, that's what it looks like. So it's Statistics Canada. I didn't go with any other websites for this information. It's all coming from Statistics Canada. So it's going to be consistent as far as the methodology and adjustments for inflation and all those factors.
Now, this is all data that's pulled from all the provinces and territories?
Yes. So we're looking at Canada as a whole.
Okay.
And then there's going to be some information that shows by different province and different area, but we'll get into that.
We'll get into a lot of stuff. And I know that the word, like, it's kind of funny how sometimes you look at screens there and what's the one word that's popping out right at me is building permits. And I know that Canada is 4 times slower than the...
We do have some information about that. Yeah, I
know. So we're going to get into that. But it's just funny that building permits just got stuck in my eye. It's been burned in my eye right now. And that's a big problem. But we'll discuss that. But that's the link. We'll share it in the notes. Yep. You guys have it. So definitely you can go and do your own homework. We encourage everybody to do their own homework.
Yeah. Like, I can show you where to look, but it's up to you about, what you want to look at, right? Yeah. At the end of the day. Okay. So this is just going to be our definitions. We're going to be talking about the different types of construction and building. So we don't have to read through every single one of these. The main ones to understand though would be the multifamily dwellings. That's going to be a large focus for us. So the difference between single family and multifamily is that it's going to contain multiple dwelling units. So that will include apartments, apartment condominiums, row houses, and semi-detached.
Which is the catchphrase of construction for the last year and a half, I guess.
Yes.
Right? But I go back to the building permit process.
Yep.
They've bottlenecked themselves by asking everybody to work on multifamily dwellings, but they've slowed everything down by the process.
Yes. So,
but we'll get into that. We'll get into that.
We'll definitely get into that. And I was trying to, and if anyone can point me in the right direction of how to get this information, but because the building permits are issued by municipalities, I wasn't able to find how many total employees that were working on the building permits. So I was trying to reverse engineer, the average time for a permit and then how many permits per year to then see if I could calculate how many people are working on these permits. But because they're all different municipalities, each one's not going to show how many people they have working in the building departments. So if we could get that information some way, we can essentially calculate, how many employees are working on how many permits? So how much time does the average building permit employee spend on one permit? And can we compare that to other countries or areas to see, is it slow that we just don't have good output from the people working on them? Or is it something in the process? But that's something I would love to dive into. It's just very difficult to find that information.
I know earlier this year I was dealing with the Mississauga building office, and I was talking to a few people that are listening to the show about my experience there. But the one good thing that I did notice about their digital platform regarding the building process is each advisor or building official that's associated with that process of that building permit attaches an hourly value.
Oh, that's good.
For their steps regarding all of it.
So at least you can track.
So you can track exactly. Yeah. So from the time it goes to the engineer to the time it goes to plumbing and HVAC or whatever it is, they actually indicate, okay. 2 hours were spent here, 3 hours were spent here. So you've got a full amount before it actually gets to you.
That's great. Yeah.
From the time it actually gets approved, and now you've got an issued permit at that point.
Okay.
So they probably would have the information regarding what the average is per permit that's applied for, and then the process it goes through, right?
Yeah. It'd be great to know that, right?
But that's
that
one way, municipality.
Yes. And I think in doing my research, I want to say there was something like thousands of municipalities. I had it in a spreadsheet. I can imagine,
for sure.
Actually, I think I have it somewhere here. But so anyway, we'll move on to...
Yeah, but you want to focus mostly on multi, right?
So I just want to show, so we'll, we'll go to the first chart there. Okay, so in this first chart, the blue line represents total residential and non-residential construction in Canada over the period of January 2011 to April 2024. And that was the most recent data I could pull. So May and June would not be included just because it wasn't published for this particular set of information. So the it shows a trend line, and it's very obvious that we're trending upward as far as the total amount of building happening in Canada. The chart is meant to be adjusted for inflation. The only point I would make is that if the inflation rate is being manipulated to show that it's not very, like, if the manipulation of it's the lowered. Rate is lowered to benefit the political powers that be, then it could be skewed that maybe inflation is higher than what they've accounted for and that there is some growth due to inflation. But if it is accurate inflation data and it's been collected the same way every year, then we know that the market is growing based on this information.
Is that why we're seeing such a dramatic dip there at January 24?
Okay, so that's going to be our COVID incident, which we have a slide, and I've got some really cool cool information surrounding COVID.
Okay, no, I don't want to get ahead of you. I want you to have it all set up properly. Yep, but yeah, absolutely. The bottom line is that based on if the inflation is true, we're still seeing growth.
We are, absolutely. Okay?
So even though everyone's talking about there's a slowdown, we're still seeing growth.
Correct.
Okay.
So the orange will represent the total residential construction, and the gray will be the total non-residential construction. Okay. So if we can go to the next slide. So this is our building trend over time, and I used a pie graph just to show the difference in the ratio. So if you look at the left, that's going to be in 2011. The orange represents the residential construction,
yep.
And then the blue represents the commercial.
Okay.
So fast forward to 2024, and the values stay the same, but the pie has grown in size. So we're still seeing a very similar split of the construction industry that is residential versus commercial. It's pretty much bang on. So it's the same ratio, and we know that those are sort of the, you know, it's a 2/3 to 1/3 ratio approximately.
Okay.
So if we go to the next slide. Okay, so this is the residential building permit value. And again, same time frame.
So the orange is single family, blue is total.
Yeah, sorry. So that is, I think it might not be represented on the chart as far back, but... yeah, that's the correct slide. But yeah, it just may have shrunk the chart. But either way, we are trending up. And so the orange represents the single dwelling building total. Mm-hmm. And what you can see is that the trend line for single dwelling building total is very flat relative or compared to the multiple dwelling building total. Which is the gray. So you can see that the multiple dwelling building total is growing at a faster rate than the single dwelling building. So multiple units in a building is the trend because of cost is going to be my guess, right? As house prices become more expensive, less people can afford the more expensive items, and then they need to go into something more affordable, which in the building process, having more units in one building, perhaps smaller, but they're going to be at a lower cost than a single family home, which makes sense.
So this growth here makes sense.
Absolutely.
Right.
So if you can tap the,
do you think you'll see the single dwelling click the go down?
It depends, I think, on the incentives and the government policies around like the land development in general. If you look at BC, Vancouver, there's not a lot of available land. And so to build single family homes on large tracts of land is not going to be very easy or possible.
Yeah.
They got to build up because they're running out of land space.
Yeah.
And then Ontario, if we don't get into the green belt, or certain areas, there's just fewer and fewer open tracts of land to build on, or perhaps the value of that land is increasing and the cost to acquire that land is going to be higher, and therefore prices are higher.
So,
if you look at the area highlighted in red, you can see that in the last quarter or two quarters, that the single family building total has been declining, but the spike and the growth in the residential building permit value has come from the multiple dwelling units. So I found that very interesting, is that we're slowing down in the single family home construction, big tract sites, but the multiple dwelling units seem to be increasing in total value or total number of units.
Yeah. Okay. That also makes sense. That's why I was questioning whether or not you're going to see a downturn on a single, which you might, or it just might go flatline again for a period of time.
Yeah. So if we go to the next slide, this is a pretty cool, so this is a pretty cool one. So if you look at 2011 to 2024, you can see that there's an inverse trend from single family to multiple dwelling units. So 61% of the residential construction in 2011 was single family.
Yep.
And then it's decreased to 33%. So you're seeing this big change in going from single family to multiple dwelling units, which I found very interesting, is that it's, you know, maybe a bit at a time, but it's been trending in this direction, and it likely will continue to trend in this direction if the cost of these single family homes continues to rise.
Which it will.
Most likely, yeah.
So that's over a 13-year period.
Correct.
We've doubled.
Yeah, so you flipped it.
Yeah. Okay, all right.
Okay. So let's go to the next slide. Here we see the percentage increase, again, over the same time period, and it's arranged by the percent increase. So if you look at the single dwelling unit at the bottom, over 12.3 years, it's only increased 18%, whereas multiple dwelling units have increased 275%. Commercial, 130%, institutional and governmental, 122%, residential in total 120. So what you're seeing in this middle section is that it's consistent across the board, give or take a few points. Like, you know, maybe industrial hasn't grown as fast as commercial, but at the same time, they're all relatively close to each other. But the biggest discrepancy is between the single family and multiple dwelling units.
Yeah, it's huge.
Which is so if you're a business owner or if you're looking to position yourself to, be successful in the future, if the trend is multiple dwelling buildings, then you're going to want to position your business to be able to take on those projects or work on those projects or meet builders who are working on these things. You want to give yourself more opportunities to where the growth is coming from versus focus your business on something that is declining.
Makes a lot of sense.
So if we go to the next slide, this is the non-residential building permit value. So the blue is the total non-residential, gray is the commercial, orange industrial, and yellow is the total institutional and government. So you can see that it is also growing, and no real big things that jump out. There's a spike in, you know, January of 2023. And I was trying to figure out, you know, what could have caused like a big spike around then. And I saw something about some bank lending legislation or something, but I wasn't able to look into it more to see if it correlated or if it caused any of this. So yeah, if we go to the next slide. So the summary for this section would be that in the residential sector, multi-dwelling is outgrowing single dwelling, but the entire industry is growing, and single dwelling construction had the slowest growth. And the unknowns for this would be that the black market or non-permit work. So there could be work going on that, wasn't recorded in this information, but we have no way of knowing, how much work that is or what the ratio is or how prevalent it is.
The bottom line is multi-dwelling versus single dwelling.
Yes.
Don't focus your efforts right now on single dwelling.
If that's what you're going to be trying, if you're going to try to be getting in more single dwelling unit work, as it declines, you're going to be competing with a lot of other people for a declining amount of work. At least that's what this information would tell us.
I'm still a little surprised that I did a show years ago with Linda Kafka. And we did a show where she's all about aging in place, mm-hmm. right? And about converting your home. So then as an elderly person, you don't get carted off to a home and
yep.
spend the rest of your years there, months or whatever it is.
Yep.
And so, you know, when she started telling me the data behind that, we were talking about like 80 something billion of dollars that are being spent just okay. in Canada alone from this segment. People are living longer
yep.
and elderly people, including myself, mm-hmm. do not want to be carted off to a home
yep.
to spend the rest of my years. And I'm still surprised that nobody has really put themselves in a position to cater to the specific market. I haven't seen it on social media. Now I'm looking at this multi-dwelling, all this data, and I'm like, if you start marketing your business to go and speak to and properly market yourself to this elderly market
yeah.
and explain to them, we'll convert your house to a multi-dwelling where you can rent part of it and you can live in the rest of it so you can actually generate income as a result of it. Mm-hmm. That's how you position your business. And I'm pretty sure you'll be busy.
Oh, yeah. Like, I think that's a great point. And there's a few slides further on that will speak to why that's a good idea as far as adding more units to existing buildings yeah. or even things like laneway suites or these garden suites. So I was speaking with another siding contractor the other day, and he was telling me that in Mississauga, they've got some pre-approved backyard suites that you don't have to go through this extensive process.
What size?
I believe it was about 600 square feet, and it was a single story, garden suite in Mississauga, but they've got, I think, a set of garden suites that are pre-approved that if you did want to do this, the drawings are already done, everything's already completed, and that you would just have to, I guess, file to start this. I don't have a ton of information on it, but if you were to think about all the existing properties that have the space to put these suites in. I've done the math on some of them, just working on a few of the laneway suites in Toronto, and the amount of rent versus the cost of these over, X time period, they do, favor the owner.
Yeah.
They will pay themselves off in a relatively short period of time that you've added living capacity and you have, created some income for yourself if the cost is lower than your rent price. And we know rent prices are high right now. So a worthwhile investment, I think, and it will help the housing shortage. I don't think it's going to solve the whole problem, but it's a good avenue to add, residential living space without having to, start going further and further and further out of the city to get the land to build on.
But if you market your primarily single dwelling construction company
yep.
in this perspective,
yep.
you're going to attract. If you go into these areas of the city, whether yep. it's Mississauga or other areas, you can offer this to them and explain to them, listen, I can create a 600 square foot
yep.
unit for you in the backyard that you guys could rent it out.
Absolutely. And I think if contractors or other companies were able to demonstrate the cost compared to the rental income
yeah.
and make the case that, yes, you're spending a larger sum of money, but at the same time, we can show that it's not going to be, a cash flow negative investment. With interest rates, if you're borrowing, perhaps at this time, it may be. If you had equity in your home, perhaps you could borrow at a lower rate or a better rate. Because I know the interest rate component is affecting a lot of people right yep. now. So, maybe not everyone's in a position to do this, but those who are, I think is a very worthwhile investment. And,
I agree.
Over time, it is going to add value to your property.
Totally agree.
So if we were to go to the next slide, and then if you click, yep.
There we go. So COVID.
Okay. So we're going to dive into the COVID incident or the COVID, scenario, because I think what we're seeing now as far as the quote unquote slowdown is actually just a correction from an abnormal abnormal spike in market activity as a result of COVID. So I believe COVID was in
2020.
So I think this, I think the numbers are skewed on the bottom of this chart. So we can send out this this slide or deck afterwards. But
yeah, that's fine.
So where that red arrow is, that's going to be approximately April 2020, around when the COVID shutdowns or lockdowns happened. So you're going to see a significant drop in activity, and that was the result of the lockdowns and everyone sort of pausing and stopping. But what that did was forced everyone into their homes. People are at home, you know, more than they normally would be.
Yeah.
And they start to see, okay, maybe I need this done, or maybe I need an office now, or maybe a backyard suite, or my roof looks like it's pretty old, it needs to be fixed, or siding's falling off, eaves troughs are leaking. So. Yeah. So I think what this did is it forced a lot of people to acknowledge some of these home items that needed to get done. And then if everyone's thinking this at the same time, it's going to cause a surge in activity.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we see.
And that's what we see. We see a big spike in activity. So if we go to...
That would have been, I guess, the second half of 2020. The fall of 2020.
Yeah, so if we go to the next slide... Okay, so we're going to look at 2020 because that would have been like the most activity in the year.
Yeah.
So you can see, again, based on the same website, same information, you can see the dollar value and it's times 1,000. So you can see the dollar value spent on the various types of work and the various buildings in the market. And so if you look on the right, the graph there, so about half of the... areas of investment were new construction, and then 46% were alterations and improvements. So you're seeing both new construction in this time period, and you're seeing alterations on existing buildings. Okay. But the total value at the bottom, it got cut off, I think, in the slide, but I think the total value for 2022, $178 billion. In 2022 of construction activity as recorded by Statistics Canada.
But that's also not the norm.
No. And so I think that's why everyone
was...
We're comparing it because everyone was so busy. And then now relative to that, maybe it's slow, but we're comparing it to something that would have never otherwise happened if there was no lockdown.
Was it twice as much?
So if we go to the next slide, I've got a...
Okay, here we go.
Okay, so this is the I call it the COVID bump. So if you look on the left, is going to be residential new construction. And the yellow bar is 2021. And then the blue bar is 2022.
Okay.
So you had the largest percent increase in 2021. But then in 2022, we still had an increase. From that previous year. So this is going to be why everyone's so busy, just the surge in total activity. And then if we were to go to the next slide, so this is the one where I think this is the best representation of what we're seeing. So if we think of that last graph as far as like a steady increase year over year in activity, we can see that in this graph, the orange is the percent change from 2018 to 2019. So we had a decrease, and then the next year we had an increase. So if over time, these decreases and increases will average out to a percent increase over the years, right? Okay. But if we look at 2020 to 2021, when COVID happened, we see a 41% spike in the residential new construction. And we see a 39% spike in the residential alterations. So what that tells us is that if our average change per year was, let's call it, you know, 8 or 10%, we are 3 or 4 times the average change in a single year. And then in 2021 to 2022, we are still increasing from that already high volume. So if you're seeing a slowdown or a perceived slowdown, it's only because... a lot of the work that would have otherwise happened, maybe spread out over time, got squished into a short time period. So I think this one's really cool in showing that, you know, it was just an abnormal time period that is skewing what we see right now.
It's kind of ironic because I've been telling all the salespeople from all the brands selling product how they're comparing their sales of 2024 to the COVID bump years.
And it's...
And you can't.
You can't, yeah.
Right? So it's the same thing. It's a very valid point that you bring up here, right? Is that as a contractor, you can't compare to those 2 years there.
No, we need a longer time frame to look at this.
You have to look at 18, 19, even a little bit further and to get an understanding of we're still on track.
I think so, yeah. The market's growing. We have record high immigration. There's already a lack of housing. So the writing's on the wall. Like I'm sure there will be another boom time, depending on what happens politically and if regulations, you know, change or if there's incentives to start building more. But I don't think Canada is going to slow down as far on building if we are continually adding more people to the country.
I think, you're right. It's multi-level is going to start to grow.
If we run out of space, we're going to have to add more units in the same footprint. So whether that's condos or...
I'd like to take a look at those Mississauga plans.
Yeah, it was interesting.
I'd be curious about it, right? Yeah, to see what they look like. I mean, 600 square feet is still a good size structure. I mean, it's a little bit bigger than the double car garage.
About 20 by 30. Yeah. And at one point in time, I was looking at, I wanted to build a tiny home, right? Maybe like Airbnb it, just, you know, buy a piece of property, build a tiny home. But then in looking into the rules and regulations, 600 square feet was like the I believe it was 600 square feet or it may have been different in certain municipalities, but there was a minimum building size. So if you look in the States, they have these like tiny home communities. In Canada or in Ontario specifically, when I was looking, there was a minimum size building you need to build. But if we have increasing costs and we have a minimum size, that creates a barrier to entry in that unless you have X amount of dollars to build this size of house, you can't do that.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there's reasons why there's a minimum size, but from what you see online, people have found ways to live in vans. They've found ways to live in shipping containers. That calls into question, do we need a minimum size or is it the like access egress and fire safety and those things?
600 square feet is pretty big.
It's still pretty big, yeah.
Yeah, like, right?
I think
tiny homes are less than that. I thought tiny homes were in around the 150 mark.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
But the question then is like, okay, well, we can have a condo that's 300 square feet, but a building on its own can't be 300 square feet. It has to be a certain size. So I think there's maybe, you know, something there that, you know, to question like why do we have these rules in place and what are they for, right? But anyways, that's on a tangent.
Well, I mean, that's the one thing that people are not understanding, and we're still going to get into the permit side of things, is that I'm still trying to wrap my head visually what a neighborhood's going to look like. If everybody's backyard had a multi-level garden suite in the backyard, what that's going to do for all the backyards at that point, right? So you've got a dwelling of a person who's living that has access and visual to the neighbor behind, to the neighbor, to you, the existing dwelling. I don't think people understand what that's really going to do. Sure, it's going to add volume and product out there for people to move into. But I think it's going to create other problems as well, too.
Likely, yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's not been fully thought through as most things. But yeah, I guess we'll see in
time.
We'll
see what happens when it starts going, because, I mean, it's coming to your neighborhood. Simple as that. People are going to try to figure out. I know that a few years ago, I started seeing a rash of people build additional space and room on top of garages.
Yes.
They were taking that because right there, a double car garage is 400 square feet. Yep. So that's a huge amount of space. So if they could figure out how you can do that out of 400 square feet, then that's an option as well too.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, the point of this show is really just about the increase that there is work out there. You just have to position yourself differently.
Absolutely.
To find that work.
Absolutely. So yeah, we're going to we'll continue. So the COVID bump summary is that COVID disrupted the industry and caused an abnormal spike in residential construction.
Yep.
The industry is seeing a correction from that spike.
Yep.
So that's the take home is that you know, don't get scared or nervous that it's going to disappear. It's just we are seeing that correction and it may take some time to get back to historical averages. So if we go to the next slide, So this slide will speak to the same thing we saw with the COVID bump in construction activity. What it caused as well is a spike in house prices. So again, same stats can cite and information. This is the new housing price index. And so again, this, I think it may not have translated on like the dates, the numbers of the dates may have not have translated correctly, but because on my screen, so if you look at where it starts to peak up, on this chart would be around, it says March 24. That would be the April, May area of 2020. When COVID happened. So you see the spike, which again on my screen is going to be over the course of 2021 and 2022. And where you see the price or the spike start to drop is the early 2023. And so the blue is the month-to-month change. And so you can see that month-to-month, it changed more over the COVID time period and that it's starting to come back down. And then same with the year-over-year change, is that we are now seeing house prices drop because we are getting the correction from that COVID bump. And then on the right, same thing, you can see that 2021... From 2020 to 2021, you have a significant increase in price. I think that, the average single family home price would have increased over $120,000 in 1 year.
Wow.
Right? And then 2022, you get a slight increase, but then 2023, it starts to drop. And then if we were to go to the next slide, so that was from Statista, which is a research department. And so same thing, they say the average Canadian house price declined slightly in 2023 after 4 years of consecutive growth. Average price stood at $678,000 Canadian dollars in 2023 and was forecast to reach $722,000 in Canadian dollars by 2025. So home sales on the rise. So so there are expected to be more home sales in 2024. With the interest rates sort of flattening out a bit, I think that will help people make the decision to then purchase a home. And should they drop, that may cause all the money on the sidelines to buy again. If people think the house prices are going to jump again, then that will be the incentive to buy.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, it's expected to continue to increase over time. It's just a matter of, when that is. Again, I'm not an expert on the financial market or the interest rates and how they affect the home sales. This is just what's available online. And for us in the construction industry, by doing the research and reading about all this stuff, we can be confident that, okay, I'm going to continue to expect growth in my business, but it may not be for a year or it may not be for X amount of time. And maybe that helps you position yourself now and to plan your growth for when this next, spike or surge in activity happens. So if we go to the next slide, but anyways, yeah, we can share the chart.
That's fine. So this is housing starts from
2011 to 2024. So the green, and I backed out the estimated component and put in the completions. So the green is the total housing completions. So the information as of January 2023 was not published or available on there. So we have up till January 2023, and that's where it drops. But you can see that the activity is still there and it is trending in the positive direction. And so it shows the difference between the total units, multiple units, which would be the yellow.
Yep.
The brown would be apartments. Light blue is single detached. The dark blue is row houses, so like townhouses.
Yep.
And then the green is going to be semi-detached. So... So yeah, you can see again that the multiple dwelling units are going to be the most prevalent or the largest number of these housing completions is going to be in the multiple dwelling.
Of course, yeah.
All right, well, if we go to the next slide. So this is Housing Starts Canada, May 2019 to 2024. So number of units. And again, we can see that it is still growing, right? It may have peaks and troughs, but overall it's trending toward growth. And so the cool part, if you look on the right, the largest year-over-year change is coming from Prince Edward Island, and the lowest is in Manitoba, where it's actually negative year-over-year change.
Prince Edward Island, really, huh?
Yeah.
That's a big difference.
Yeah, so 857% change in starts in Prince Edward Island, and month-to-month, 644% change. So I'm not sure what's happening out that way. Maybe someone out east who you know may be able to speak to, maybe there's you know, some investment in some area going in that's
last conversation I had with somebody that's out there. I know an architect that moved out there after his divorce. and then I also know somebody else that has a retail location. The last conversation I heard was they were actually putting a stop on a lot of people moving to PEI.
Putting a stop to it. Oh.
They were trying to limit this. So this information is coming from what May of this year?
May 2024. Yeah, so.
It's interesting. So this I should give them a call and find out. Because that's a huge bump. Maybe that's the reason why they put a stop, but I
perhaps.
Don't know. Perhaps.
I think what you're seeing is, again, with what we talked about in the last show, with Canada's population demographics, you have a large cohort of baby boomers that maybe have houses in cities where they're very valuable, and they want to then move to cottage country, or yeah, they want to move to provinces where it's they can get better value for their money. They can sell their, you know, $1 million home in Ontario, and then they can buy something in PEI for half the price or something like that, right? Where they can capture the difference in the new house and then the equity from their old house. So I think a lot of those factors or a lot of those scenarios factor into some of these patterns that we see, is that the retirees who would have excess, you know, cash or resources or have assets that they can sell to then move, maybe cause some of these changes.
So you're saying in May 2024, the housing starts, the amount, so in all of Canada is 21,652?
I believe so. If not, it was times 1,000. I would have to refer back to the website, but it was more just to show the relative.
Okay. No, I was just trying to get to the point where it's as far as whatever our current government is talking about on how many homes they want us to be building by 2030, that number alone is what they're expecting to build on a daily basis.
Yeah.
which I'm looking at this and I'm like, okay, well, that's what we're achieving now with realistic terms.
Right.
Right. And even with the spikes and everything like that. So it's like, that's from 2019 to 2024. I'm like, we can't achieve these numbers is what I'm trying to go with.
Yeah. Again, I got to check if it was multiplied by 1,000. Because that was in the other set of information. Everything on the data was times 1,000. So if that was the case, then we would be at, 200 or 200 something thousand?
Yeah, 216,000, right?
216,000.
So it'd be a good idea to start a multi-level construction company in PEI.
Perhaps, yeah. If there's demand for those type of units, or if... Again, if it was a result of people from, let's say, Ontario moving to PEI, which demographic of people are moving there, and then what are they moving there for? Yeah. Like, are they moving there to be in an apartment or multi-dwelling building, or are they moving there because they can get a piece of land at a lower cost?
It's surprising, right? Like, to see Saskatchewan and Manitoba in the negatives.
Yeah, which... Not sure why, and I'm sure you may know some people or have some guests or people follow the show that can speak to what's happening in these areas.
Alberta makes sense that it's gone up, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because you can move from Ontario to Alberta and, you know, maybe get a similar job, and your housing costs will be significantly cheaper. So if we go to the next slide.
Interesting.
So this shows the growth in housing starts by the different areas. So again, on my screen, it shows the different, the different cities.
Okay.
So the one in the middle there, that's Ottawa Gatineau. So that would be where the most starts or has the largest month-to-month change relative to the other areas.
Okay.
And the ones that are in the negatives, as far as the month-to-month change or year-over-year change, are going to be Manitoba, Saskatchewan, St. John, Peterborough, Kitchener, Cambridge, Brantford, Guelph, London, Windsor, Barrie, Winnipeg, Regina. But then you see in areas like Thunder Bay, that's the second highest spike. Hamilton's got the third highest spike as far as month-to-month change. So it's going to vary between regions as far as like where the building's happening and where it's not, or where it's growing or not growing. And I would imagine this is all going to be a result of like land acquisition and developments that have been started years ago that now they're coming to fruition, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about the building permit process and how long that takes. So there's a term called latency, right? So from when you start to when it actually gets shovels in the ground building, there's a latency, right? So something that's being built now may have started the process a year ago or 6 months, right? We don't know in which areas it's faster, slower. So we can't necessarily say like it's directly from this or that if we don't know how long the building permit process takes. If that makes sense.
I see what you're saying. It totally makes sense. I get it. But we can't get that data.
I'm going to continue to try to find like how long it takes to get permits or the average time for permits in certain areas.
Well, right now, it doesn't matter what data you're looking at or whoever you're speaking to right now. I would say that building permits is hindering the process instead of helping the process.
In one of the slides, it shows our ranking in the time to get a building permit compared to other countries, and ours is kind of embarrassing. I would say. But we'll get to that one. Yeah.
So this is the residential dwelling unit purchases in 2021, which would have been COVID.
Yes. So this would have been COVID, and this was. The latest year I could get the information for this particular information. What it's meant to show is that so the multiple dwelling units are becoming increasingly more popular or growing. And I think part of the reason is that if you look at the census data, which is what this is, you can see that between the blue and the orange, the blue represents a one-person household, and the orange represents a two-person household. So between the blue and the orange, over 62% of the people living in whatever type of housing are either one or two people.
Yeah.
So most of our population, or the majority of our population, are single or two people living in a building. So do you need a full single family detached house if the majority of people are one or two people living in a space, right? So that's what this shows us, is that just the difference in size of families or like people living together in a unit. So it makes sense that maybe the average size of a house or dwelling unit is shrinking because of less people. And then if they're shrinking, you could fit many in one, like one land footprint.
Yeah.
Right. And then at the same time, we could see the split between owners and renters. So about a third of the Canadian population at this time was, renters. And I would be curious to see,
I think it's flipped.
I'd be curious to see now what that is. I think with the rising cost of everything, you're probably going to have more renters than what's displayed here.
Yeah, for sure you will.
But yeah, I found that very interesting, is that the majority of our population either lives by themselves or with one other person.
So back in 2021, that would have been the situation. So that more than 50%, so you're talking about, 63% is one or two people.
Yep.
63% of that. And then 67% of that, they own that property instead of renting it.
Correct. Sure. At this time.
At that time, 2021. Yeah, 3 years ago. Okay.
Okay, so if we go to the next Okay, so yeah, here again, just to demonstrate the same pattern, this is dwelling units created. So it's not permits, it's not value of anything. This just shows the actual number of units created, just to reinforce that, again, we are trending downward on the number of units that we are creating. So if in the previous slide, we were still had a slight trend upward in the permits or value of the residential units, this shows us that we're building less houses. And if the value is slightly increasing, it means it's getting more expensive to build less single family units. Where you look at the yellow, which would be the multiple dwelling, and that matches the same growth that we saw as far as the value and the permits. Mm-hmm. So it's becoming more expensive to build single family dwelling units. And therefore, they're going to be less desirable, or people will be less likely to buy the more expensive single family unit. At least that's what this is showing us. Unless there is some significant change in the number of single family dwellings that become available, like if the market got flooded with them, then the supply demand dynamic flips.
It's interesting because that's 12-year period. And that single family dwelling, it's stayed pretty steady, but then it's also dropping now, right? As of the last 2 years.
I think so, yeah.
Meanwhile, the multi's gone up.
Yes. So
do you think the single's going to stay that way for the next 12 years? You think the multi will continue to climb? It has to, based on immigration, based on how many people coming in, and based on how many people can afford single.
I think it comes down to affordability. That's the main thing, is the affordability. And so the affordability is like two components, right? So it's either the purchase price or the amount of money you make relative to be able to afford that unit. So
or get approved for a mortgage.
Or get approved. So if your income were to significantly increase, then and the house price stayed the same, you could afford to buy that house. If your income did not increase, but the house prices drop, now it becomes affordable. Mm-hmm. So it's either got to be one or the other in order to increase the purchases of the single family homes, right?
What's the approval rating nowadays for to get a mortgage? If you want $1 million mortgage,
I have no idea.
Have to be making over 150 grand, right? Times two, because you dual income.
I think the stress, or not stress test, I think that it's like the debt ratio to your income, right? So I believe it's somewhere in the neighborhood of, like, I want to say anywhere from like 2 to 4, like debt to income. So if you had a mortgage of $1 million and it was at 4, then that would suggest that combined income you would need to make $250,000. I don't know exactly, but I
know
you'd probably have to get like a mortgage specialist on,
but that's what I think is that's what's going to contribute to that single family staying the way it is and having the multi climb.
I think so. Yeah. If people can't afford these large mortgages or, aren't confident in their ability to keep up with the payments and whatnot, then the more affordable option will be a smaller living space in a multi-dwelling building.
But going back to work and finding the work, it doesn't completely dismiss single family.
No.
Because you just have to market yourself differently now.
Yes.
The people that are still buying the single dwellings,
yep,
they're going to want renovations as well.
Yep.
But it's just you have to position yourself differently now.
Yeah, and that's what this information is meant to do, is just help people position themselves better for the future, right?
Yeah.
So I think we all have a skewed idea of the residential market from COVID, and we saw that it was an abnormal spike. So if you are positioning your business to do that type of work, but there's no big policy change or there's going to be no surge in the residential again, then maybe that's not the best position for you at this time, right? Or the best strategy at this time. So again, if you have, the ability to go online and just check in on the site every month and see what
you'll see where it's at,
see what the trends are. Exactly, right? And that'll help you as a business owner to see where you're going to spend your time or which projects to pursue. Yep. And I think it's valuable. And again, you can crowdsource this information or talk to other contractors in order to confirm what we're seeing, right? If we see a decrease in this area, you know, and you know a contractor in this area, hey, is it true? I saw this, and yeah, it is slow here, but I hear this area's got large demand. So between the publicly available information and connections in the market, I think you can, you know, at least mitigate any, you know, slowdown or lack of work.
I think you're just gonna be better prepared.
Absolutely.
And then your thought process would be differently. I mean, like, to be honest, Ryan, like 10, 20 years ago, you wouldn't have contractors considering this.
Oh, what? Sorry.
They wouldn't be looking at this as data and going, okay, based on this information that I've researched on, this is where I think things are headed.
Yeah.
Like that's not, but today you can do that.
Yeah.
This information's here, right?
Absolutely. And again, your platform is fantastic. Is you're able to reach thousands of people for free, right? Yeah. Like to other people, it's free, and they can get this information without having to pay any money.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you see reports come out, but you have to buy the report to then read it, and you know it's probably 30 pages. But something like this, we can relay the information very easily and widespread.
It basically reaffirms what we started the whole show about, where it's the work is out there.
Absolutely.
It's just positioning yourself differently now.
Correct.
Simple.
Yep.
Okay.
And perhaps there's, new products or, new building methods that are going to be growing in the future that you may want to learn new skills, or you may want to start working with different products or products that are being used more in order to differentiate yourself, right? You had a guest on that talked about the prefab.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Farrow. Farrow International.
Excellent podcast. I love that.
Sabrina, yeah.
Yeah, that was, she's very well spoken, by the way. Yeah, that was really good. But I think that whole idea of the new methods for building is going to become a good option in the future. And so if we go to the next slide, I looked into the prefab stuff because in our last show, we talked about the automation. Yep. And then you hear about the prefab and how that's growing over time. And so I think she brought up that in residential, they don't see a good use case for the prefab in the custom.
In her particular assembly line, the way she's designed things, yes. I will say that there is something coming down the pipe where there's a machine that's been developed in New Zealand that is making its way this year to Canada.
Okay.
And it's being primarily used for a similar avenue that Farrell's doing, going the more commercial and industrial construction, but it has the capability to start getting into the single family or multi-level.
Is it a printer?
It's not a print. It's a metal fabricator.
Okay.
Where it's a lot of metal framing, but it's a unit. It's a machine that.
Oh, a roll former.
Yeah.
Oh, it's,
but it's creating all of your walls, and then they're all modular built at that assembly or on site, because you can park this machine on site, comes out of a container, a C-can, and now you can create all your modular walls and assemble them on site, speed up the process of building a structure.
Oh, absolutely.
It's being designed no different than Farrell's doing their thing, where it's designed specifically for those medical units or the standard shape structure.
Yeah, like a repeatable.
Yeah, repeatable. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, when you start getting into custom world, that's where I think that we're maybe two or three steps away from actually someone trying to figure out, I can take this machine, I can mess around with some of the software attached to this, and I can make it customizable where I can get it out there as fast as possible.
Yeah.
But as a business owner, if you were to start setting that up and you go into different parts of Canada and there's smaller towns or whatever, you can park this machine there and then fabricate that house right then and there, put it on piers, and you've got a house done.
Oh, absolutely.
That's where I see the future happening with this.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, right? It's about the the efficiency of the building, and however you're able to achieve that, the better, right? So an example of what you're talking about is, so if you look in roofing, right? If you do like standing seam roof or, let's say corrugated or like long panels, probably 10 years ago, you would have to order everything through the manufacturers. Yep. They had these big roll form machines that are in a warehouse. And then if you wanted 30-foot panels, they'd have to put it on a big truck, forklift off the truck and then onto site. Trying to do that in Toronto where you have the tight access is an absolute nightmare. So that's difficult.
But now fast forward.
But you fast forward and so what you're seeing, and I see it all the time on Instagram. I can, you know, shout out the companies who I've seen do this, but they buy these portable roll form machines. And so there's a few manufacturers of these portable roll forming machines, but essentially they're rolling the panels to length on site, and then they're installing them as soon as they're rolled off the back of the machine. And so what that does is it creates efficiency in that you don't have to have a semi-truck drive with 40-foot panels and a forklift. If you need a 30-foot panel, you run a 30-foot panel. Yeah. If you need whatever size panel, you run it. And you have less waste. You can expedite the time in which you can then complete the job. So that's an example, and to your point, of finding efficiency. And a lot of that may be, producing some products on site or not being far from the source of the products.
If you're not a contractor paying attention to some of these tools, these new tools, you'll be missing opportunities here.
Yep. Or even one of the ones I think is just a fantastic product is the zip system.
Yeah.
Right. In siding, a lot of the time, if built with plywood, if the framers didn't put the Tyvek on the wall, on the ground, and then stand it up, then you've got this big plywood wall that you then have to go Tyvek. Let's say the windows aren't in, but they want a waterproof. Then you got to have one guy or two guys on a ladder Tyveking the building, so then the builder can keep it waterproof and keep moving.
Yep.
But for us, that's a bit of a waste of a mobilization. If we're putting ladders up or putting scaffold up, we want to do the Tyvek, we want to do the insulation, we want to do strapping. You know, if we could do the siding, we want to do it all in one shot. But now we've got one mobilization for Tyvek, and then we got to take all our stuff away, and then we got to come back for the next stage, and then maybe we're ready for siding at that point. But with the zip system, it's a waterproof layer. If the framers were to put the tape on when the wall is down, when they stand it up, you have like just a connection band between the two floors, and it becomes very efficient. So, choosing great products or choosing products that allow you to become efficient, I think is going to be a strategic advantage. So, we've been doing it like this for 20 years, but the new way, maybe the product is more expensive, but it will save you money or save you time and labor.
I think it also will attract more clients.
Yeah, because they want a better house at the end of the day, right?
Yeah, no, totally. So you had the graph here about the prefabs, right? So non-residential. Yeah,
we're talking about the prefab or expediting the building process by leveraging maybe a controlled work environment outside of the construction site. So I looked into, okay, is prefab becoming more popular? And so the information right now shows that, in the residential sector, currently declining as far as the, I believe it was the total number of permits.
Okay.
So maybe less permits in the residential, but it seems like the commercial and industrial area was where it would be more prevalent. And so institutional and government is currently trending upward. And then the commercial had a big spike 2022 and has dropped down a bit. I still think it's a bit early to make any conclusions on the prefab now, because it's early in the...
It's way too early.
It's early in the development.
Yeah. I think in the next, if you want to look at it at 12 years from now, a decade, you're going to see a spike. You're going to see... It's going to climb. So. Yeah, it's 100% going to climb.
Well, so I saw another a guy on Instagram. I think it's a Japanese framing crew. And you follow their day-to-day. That's what they post about. But very interesting in that they didn't have a full prefabbed like unit of a building, but what they had was prefabbed wall sections with the windows and door frames and everything made, where it was an incremental section of like 10 or 20, 30 feet, okay. And they would crane that into place. And then the crew would just have a like a tongue and groove or like an overlap connection point with okay. The top plate, right? So if you have a double top plate, maybe one overhung this way and then one was set back.
Yeah.
So they could literally crane it in place. And it was a three-man crew where the crane is doing the heavy lifting. Most of the complex cuts and doors and windows and layout, that's already done off-site. And then on the site, there was one guy with a nail gun. The others just had a hand nail and some spikes just to tack it in place. And then you had one guy just doing all the nailing. And it's super efficient in that they're not lifting anything heavy. They're not operating dangerously. There's not multiple hoses that they could trip on. You know, if you're just tacking a wall so it doesn't move, you don't necessarily need to keep a nail gun. Just a hammer and some spikes and then let the one guy nail everything.
Where are they building?
It was just wood frame residential houses, and I think it's
In the States or in Canada?
No, I think like in Asia.
Oh, in Asia.
I don't know if it was Japanese, maybe Korean, but
okay.
I'll send you
I'd love to take a look at
that. But it was fascinating because, three guys and they could put up like a building in short time because, again, walls are already made, the crane's doing the heavy lifting, and they're just assembling it.
Yeah, it's all simple.
Yeah, very simple.
Next slide.
Yeah, if we go to the next. So when we talk about the length of permits, and we could probably do a whole podcast about just the permit process, because there's a lot of information and I'd need more time to know it entirely or better than I do now. So this is from 2020, and so in this it shows that we ranked 34th out of 35 among the OECD countries in time to obtain a permit for a new general construction project. And so this is just an excerpt. I didn't write this myself. This is just from the article, but it's a telling and embarrassing statistic for a G7 economy. It takes nearly 250 days to get a permit in Canada, three times longer than our competitors in the United States. Only the Slovak Republic takes longer. And but this is as of 2020. I don't know
what it is last year.
Yeah, I don't know what it would be last year.
I think it's gotten worse.
Well, or yeah, what general construction project means.
We're 35 now. I don't know. Maybe.
Perhaps.
But even still, at that period in time, and we're 34th, we're taking 168 days longer
than the States, and we have similar building practices to the States. Especially the northern states where they have the winters like we would have winters, that would probably be the best comparison. Like we couldn't compare our building to what they build in Florida or North Carolina or whatever, right? Like the slab on grade, we just, in Ontario, we don't do a lot of that, I think.
What's this point here? There's a point there. It says RBC, which is a bank, Canada has lost $100 billion in investment over the past 2 years. That's from 2020 or no, 2021.
This would have been in 2020, so they would have been saying 2018, 2019.
And they've lost $100 billion because of these slowdowns with permits.
Yeah, I imagine if you're, you know, either a Canadian wanting to invest in building something, or if you're a foreign investor, you have to consider, you know, if you are spending money to then start a business or a property, or you're spending money on an investment. If your time to get paid back on that investment is not going to be for multiple years, you may not even do it, right? So if you're looking to, you know, build a factory or a warehouse or whatever, only the big players are going to be able to float that cost over that long time period, right? For like a small company to float a lot of money over a short period or a long period of time, it's risky, right? Like, you could take a haircut, or like, if the interest rate changed and you had a line of credit that was variable or something. Anyway, lots of factors.
There's a huge amount of issues here. Like, I actually remember when the SkyTrain in BC there was being built. I remember that. And now I'm just noticing that you made a point here. It's the last, like 1994, and no money, you know, in the budget to replace Massey Tunnel. And I was just in Turkey there, and it was tunnels everywhere. And I mean, like, that's how they made things move. You know, in a tunnel, you can't go right or left. You're going to point B is what you're doing. So it's like, you want to move this country, you need to start creating more of this infrastructure to move people around. So that creates construction, that creates work. And that's, you know, helping the labor force. That's helping everything. But money's being wasted elsewhere. And they should be ashamed of themselves that it's taking 250 days to get a permit in Canada on average.
Yeah. So I think the question to ask is why, or what is causing the process to take so long? Is it that it's understaffed and the staff can't
That's the number process? One reason I keep hearing it.
Yeah.
It's understaffed, but the staff is mostly working from home.
I'm again, not sure about that. I would love to do more research into the building permit process, but yeah, ask the question, why is it taking us so long to process building permits? You know, is it that the permits or the applications being submitted are so wrong that they need Incomplete. To be edited too many times? Like maybe the education for the people putting together the applications is lacking, or is it the actual process? Like if you had submitted a permit and there's like three or four revisions to get to the point where it's acceptable, maybe it's on the submission end, not the one approving it, right? So I don't know. I don't know what would it be taking so long.
I'd be very curious to see what it is right now, currently, last year. But I'm not very hopeful that it's less than 250 days. But even at that number, three times more than the US.
And I can imagine that with, you know, AI and everything going on these days, there probably is a use case for, you know, scanning drawings with some kind of AI program to flag, you know, certain things,
idea.
Right?
It's a very good idea.
Like, could you automate some of these processes, right? I saw one really cool thing, and this is what my prediction for, like, construction and AI is that estimating off a set of drawings over time, an AI program, I think, will be able to put together like a comprehensive estimate at some point in the future, right?
For sure.
Because if you think about it this way, right? So a human draws the drawings in a CAD file, but it's scaled, right? So if you know what the line represents, you can then calculate the material given the length, and then you can multiply by the height and whatever, subtract openings. So a human draws the drawing, and then you know, another human will then do a takeoff, maybe with the software, to get the quantities, right? But there's room for error in this. And then when it comes time to do the work, maybe you know, there was an error in the estimation end that then ripples through the pricing and then ripples through the production.
Yeah.
So if an AI program could be incorporated or used to really nail down the quantities of what you're building, I think it will eliminate a lot of error in a variety of areas, right?
To submit it and speed up the process on the building side of things, building department. It's a very good idea. I like that idea a lot, actually. It makes sense.
Yeah. Cause yeah, like, so what do they say? Get three estimates, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you want to get three estimates and then you submit to three companies, now you have three estimators all estimating the same thing, right? Spending their time, maybe one's more efficient than the other or one's slower, whatever. But now you're spending three people's time to get the quantities, which may be the same, they may be different. And then you're going to go with one of those contractors, right? So if we want to get costs down, and an estimator is a significant cost of a business, could it be to the point where the architect or whoever is designing the house can incorporate the quantities in their design because it's been taken over by a computer, right? Like, But that's often what I think about.
You could easily do that. You could totally do that because, and that doesn't have to be information that's submitted to the actual city, but that could be a content page that's contributed to your project now at that point. So
yeah, it could be.
So at the same time, they're double checking that the drawings are good. They're developing the material list, and now you have that information so you can start pricing things out.
100%. Yeah. Because I think that's where there's a lot of discrepancy or a lot of error and issues is that like an architect can design a building and it's in vector space. It's in a perfect world, right? Everything works.
Yeah.
But then, you know, if there's revisions and changes, but that doesn't get relayed to the guys who've priced it or on site or whoever, then there's error, right? Or if something on the drawings looks good, but then the contractor or someone building it says, oh, we can't do that, it's not going to work. That's also then a revision or a change, yeah. And that takes more time and then less efficiency. And so I think there's programs like the larger commercial guys, especially mechanical guys, will use for interferences, like the BIM,
yeah,
the BIM software. So they're already able to, you know, find the interferences on these bigger projects with this software, right? So why could they not at the same time have a detailed material list when designing the building? And that will eliminate a step for the subcontractor in that, you know, the material list already exists and it's based on a computer. Because I think if I were to receive a set of, you know, takeoffs from someone like that a human did, I can't trust it because if there's an error and I priced it based on that, ultimately it's my fault because I didn't do my due diligence.
Yeah.
But if everyone operates in pricing this job off of the same guaranteed 100% solid estimate sheet and quantities from the computer, then the onus is on the design. Right. Or then there was an error in the calculation from the design side.
So who's paying or who's absorbing the cost of this AI software?
I don't know. Maybe it's more valuable for the designer to charge more for their design that has quantities.
Yeah.
But maybe that extra upcharge prevents you know, a huge amount of time and money on the back end.
Saved on the back
end. Right? Like you spend a bit more on the front end, but you save a lot of time, resources, and energy on the back end, and then you expedite the process. Again, this is just an idea.
No, it's a great idea. I like it.
I'm sure there's a lot of holes in the argument that you could point out. And I think it's not something that maybe right now will work, but in 10 years, 15 years, who knows, right?
I'd be curious to find out the data from this regarding the 250 days to get a permit, if they could split up the permits to single, multi, and high rise.
Oh, to see.
I want to see if.
Which takes longer, shorter. And
yeah, like I can only assume maybe the single and multi are taking longer than high rise.
Yeah.
Because high rise is a lot of bureaucracy, political, you know what I mean, to get that permit going so they can start developing, start doing the land and start working at that point. And then you get their team involved to start making sure that project goes smooth. I can only assume that. I don't know. I don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm. It would also be good to collect information or have information just to see where the snags are. Like, so if in residential, it on average took, you know, this long, but, you know, 40% went back for revisions because of this reason.
These reasons, yeah.
We could then target those reasons in order to speed up the process, right? So it's like if it was flagged for, I don't know, access egress, right? Maybe that's something then that you could educate the people designing so that way you can, you know, reduce these errors. Again, just
I know, but you're asking our government to become efficient when they're really good at just wasting money. And then if you leave this AI program to assist the building permit process and to help the contractors to already facilitate a material list, they're just going to create another ArriveCan app.
Well, I don't even necessarily, like you said, I don't think we necessarily need help. Like, we got to help ourselves.
Yeah.
So I think if we could just get the information, like, just like what we did here, right?
What other industry is doing something similar to that?
Which, sorry?
The material side of things. I'm just wondering if there's another industry that's doing something similar, like, I don't know, farms, agricultural. Oh. Are they quantifying, or are they looking at land and square footage? Are they looking at how many heads of whatever, and they trying to figure out, okay, we've got X amount of heads. That means we need this much feed. That's what we need.
Oh, right.
Like, I'm trying to figure out if there's already an industry that's not construction that has already implemented something like that, that can be converted for construction.
Not sure.
I don't know. I'm just thinking outside right now.
Yeah.
I think it's a brilliant idea. And that's going to be some kid that's already figured it out, or some kid that's coming into construction that will figure it out. But like a lot of great industries that excel, they look towards other industries to see what they've done to perfect their business.
Right.
And then take that information and bring it to our industry, which is the best way to do things.
Yeah.
And that's what we're asking everybody here to do now.
Yeah.
You look at your business and see what's working, what's not working.
Yep.
And see where people need to be projects to be approved.
Right.
And then we're telling you to stop paying attention to single family, or shift gears on single family.
Yeah, not even to move away from it, but just the understanding that it may not
be the bread and butter,
be the same, and then be open to working in other areas or learning new things and not being a one trick pony. Like being diversified in what you're able to do, I think will protect you when the slowdowns come. Because, you know, if you...
It's construction. There's always slowdowns.
Yeah. Like, if you only do this thing and then all of a sudden this thing, no one really wants to do it right now, then okay, like, yeah, I'm going to say, oh, I'm out of work or blah, blah, blah. But if you're able to do multiple different things, then you can always shift gears as needed and when needed, which I think is just good advice for everybody in an industry. And a comparable note, I think there's a saying in like investment, it's like diversification is like to protect your assets, and then concentration is to grow your assets. It's something along those lines, right? Like, if you want to get like really strong returns, you got to concentrate, and if you want to protect your assets, you diversify. Right. So if you think about it that way, if you want to protect your business against slowdowns where you may have to like lay people off, you want to diversify.
It's asset allocation.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing. You're just putting a little bit in each bucket.
Yeah.
So if one does tank, you still got the other buckets to kind of work with you. And that's the same thing when it comes to construction. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
You can't, it's the ones that have pigeonholed themselves and left in one.
Yeah.
We're only this type of builder. We're only this kind of contractor. They're the ones that are really suffering because they got to get rid of that mentality and start for looking at other opportunities, right?
Absolutely.
Was there another slide or no?
No, that was it for today.
Well, it's kind of sad to, you know, here's another list that Canada's made at the bottom, which is great, but it's becoming a trend. So be it. But yeah, I totally appreciate you, Ryan, to bring in all this stuff. And I want the younger generation that hasn't gone through this to understand that there's a way out of this, not leaving the industry.
Yes.
Because that's always an option too.
Yep.
You'll get a large portion of people that are not as passionate about the industry.
Yep.
And they'll just say, well, fuck it, I'm going to get out and I'm going to go do something else now. But that's not really the solution. If you are really skilled and passionate about being in this industry, then you should be looking at opportunities like this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of other trades guys can speak to this. I'm sure you can speak to this. But I think the whole idea of, oh, I'm going to be a dirty construction worker working with my hands and all this for the rest of my life, I think we need to dispel that myth.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, look at you. You started construction. Now you run a podcast and you're doing incredibly well with it.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that if you go into construction, you will always be an installer. If you want to be, great. Like, there's always going to be a need for that. But there are needs for other positions, supervisors.
Training, you're going to be handing it off. Training, mentoring.
Project management.
Yeah.
So you could start your own business.
But then, like you brought the AI development. Like, there's a bunch of kids absolutely. Right now that can figure out digital tech
yep.
that we need.
Yep.
We desperately need.
Yeah, for sure. And anything that can, create efficiency in our industry is going to get adopted.
Yeah.
I think it's...
As long as we can navigate through the marketing bullshit waters.
Yeah.
Because I think in the same respect that we're asking and we're desperately need this digital adoption of certain things, mm-hmm. there's other companies that are taking advantage of those situations. And they'll such come, like they'll come or? In and they'll create, let's say they create a piece of software or some sort of digital component.
Oh,
that they'll just yes. look at it like, okay, so I know for a fact that globally speaking, there's 230 million people that work in construction.
Okay.
Right. That's globally. Right.
Okay.
So then they start looking at numbers. You start taking a country like Canada or a country like the US, you start figuring out if I create a product that I know that if I market well, I can get 10% of that market, right. that industry,
yep.
to buy my product.
Yep.
If they're looking at that product being developed for that purpose, just to touch a market, then you're not really solving the solution. You're taking advantage of the industry, which is what I have a problem with. So I'm starting to see a lot of digital adopters like that coming into the construction industry. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is prime to make some money off of.
Right.
Which I have a problem with, right? It's no different than I remember a long, long time ago, 20, 30 years ago, I was having a conversation with a Chinese friend of mine. And he was just telling me about how, you know, back then there was all kinds of, you know, companies producing products and then they didn't care about where their off materials mm-hmm. or whatever were being right, leached right. into, right?
Okay, yeah,
and
yeah.
you had cities and then all of a sudden you hear about maybe 1 million Chinese people died as a result of this, right?
The runoff.
Yeah, the runoffs, yeah, yeah. right? And then all of a sudden you start talking about it, like, geez, that's 1 million people.
Yeah.
Because 1 million people in China doesn't mean anything. What's wrong with you, man?
Yeah.
There's small cities in China are 23 million people. That's a small city.
Yeah.
So bigger than the GTA all combined, mm-hmm. right? So it's just, it's a numbers game. They start talking about how if you get a product and sell it to a Chinese market or another market and you get a percentage of that market,
yeah.
you're hugely successful
yeah.
at that point. And they're looking at construction yeah. like that right now.
Well, so I think at the end of the day, everyone, even contractors, like everyone's going to be in business or create products or do whatever to make money. So,
yeah.
so like, I'm not necessarily surprised that there's going to be, you know, big players in the industry who are like, oh, we see an opportunity to make money. I think for you as a business owner or you in the trades, does this product or item or whatever produce a return for me?
Yeah.
Right? That's the question.
That's the question to ask first.
That's the first question. It's like, if I utilize this whatever program or this software or this, is there a return on the money spent? And is it gonna do something for me that benefits me? So as an example, I've shown a few people this now, is that takeoff softwares,
yeah,
a huge increase in the amount of output, right? If you're okay, I worked at a larger commercial company at one point in time. It was just a short stint, but it was not the right work environment for me. And so I was one of I think 7 or 8 estimators. Okay. I was in the cladding estimating. I think there's three of us in the cladding, and then there's like 5 or 6 in the roofing. So day one, I go in, and there's still guys in this big commercial company, like, you know, one of the commercial industrial roofing contractors. But there, at the time, there were still guys printing off drawings and using rulers to do their calculations, because that's what they've always done.
Yeah.
And so I was sitting there, I'm like, because I had only ever learned on a takeoff software.
Of course, yeah.
And so then they were utilizing one that was free. It was like an Adobe, I think, function or something, but it wasn't built to do construction takeoffs. It was just to calculate areas and perimeters.
Yep.
And so for me, it was like very non-intuitive, and I was like struggling. I was like, look, can we please just get this software? And then the one guy was like, well, I think the department out west, like, they got it and they said they like it and it helps them. I'm like, well, yeah, like, it's what I've been trained on, it's what I know.
They're just reluctant, they didn't want to.
They're reluctant, and part of it I think was cost, but at the time it only cost $1,200, and I And I would walk by the owner's Lamborghini or Ferrari or whatever sports car he had at the time in the parking lot. So, okay, we can't get a $1,200 program, but like it just wasn't adding up. And to me, it's like it all starts at the estimate, right?
Yes.
The quote starts at the estimate. Once you get the job, the quantities to order your material starts at the estimate. The amount of labor you need starts at the estimate. So why would we not invest money in the one of the most critical parts of the business? So, I got the program. Okay. So we got the program. And then a couple days later, we meet to review the job, and they were blown away by the number of estimates I could do relative to the other guys. And so I was kind of like sitting there like laughing. I'm like, okay, if it's, I have to fight just to get like a software that most of the industry uses. Like, I don't know that there's going to be much room for me to.
How long were you there for?
About 3 months, 3.5 months. That's
But they're still using the estimate software. Probably.
I would imagine now they are, it was not like it's very like, stagnant environment personally for
construction
me,
but, man yeah. They're so set in their ways.
Yeah, like my desk was like spotless clean and everyone was just stacks of paper everywhere, and it didn't jive with me. I was like, I don't get it.
I mean, bottom line is this information that you brought here today, it's hugely valuable, because I think if you're a young or old tradesperson, I think what you need to do is, okay, what's my market? Mm-hmm. Where do I sell my service?
Yep.
And look at your potential client
yep.
differently now.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can package yourself to be a different contractor for single family, mm-hmm. do it. But understand that there's a huge opportunity for multi.
Yes.
And look at that and look at what services you can offer for multi.
Yep.
And then focus on that. And pretty sure through these next 2-3 years of hardships that are going to go on in mm-hmm. construction, you'll survive.
Yes.
You'll survive and you'll thrive. I think yep. you'll thrive.
Well, you could even if you're a smaller company, maybe you can't win that contract directly. But maybe the company that holds that contract needs labor, and you could be a subcontractor to that larger 100%. Contractor, right? That's yeah. still an option. Same company I was at, I was talking about the software. They would have loved to have good qualified subcontractors that could go perform the labor, because often a subcontractor to a business is a better option or more profitable or less costly than hourly employees, yeah. right? There's incentive behind the pace of work. Whereas hourly employees, you don't have that same incentive. So some of these larger commercial companies, if you were, punctual, if you spoke well, if you communicated well and were able to correspond with them and do a good job on site, like I'm sure you'd get tons of work, right? But you don't wanna, like, if you're going to pursue those opportunities, then you would need to take them seriously and treat them with the same respect that you would treat a client directly.
Yeah.
Right.
But that goes back to your thought process of diversity. So yep. all of a sudden now you start expanding your toolbox.
Yep.
You're starting to add more value to your services that you're offering.
Mm-hmm.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
So stop spending the time and effort complaining that there's no work out there, and start focusing your efforts on all the work that is out there.
Yeah, go make some connections, reach out to people. I'm sure as long as you're polite and you ask for the right person to get in contact with at some of these other companies, I'm sure like lots of guys would love to have a chat to say, okay, like let's see some of the stuff you've done in the past. Maybe there's a fit. Or, in some cases, if I've got asked for, do you have any work? Like, oh, you know what? At the moment, I'm focusing on this stuff, but my friend was asking me if I knew anybody, I'll refer you.
Yeah.
Those are huge, right? So.
Okay, Ryan, that's it. Thank you again, man.
Thank you
really
much.
Appreciate it. Keep on putting this stuff together, and then
absolutely.
We'll share the links and we'll put everybody, so anybody's got questions, they can reach out to you. Ryan Brokowski from the Exterior Specialist, www.exteriorspecialist.ca, and also on IG under @exteriorspecialist, and then his email is info@theexteriorspecialist.ca.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.
Awesome.